So, I'm still Eve Prangpluse, and this is still No Nonsense Nutrition. And you know what's true is at this time of the year, I hear a lot about, well, let's call it melancholy. It's a new word, just got invented last night when I opened up the New York Times and saw somebody else got it. Instead of melancholy, it's melancholy. It's that time of the year that for some people isn't merry and bright. It's a time of the year that brings up painful memories. It's a time of the year that maybe you're not partnered with anybody and, you know, you're feeling alone or lonely. And remember, being alone doesn't mean you're lonely, and being lonely doesn't mean you're alone. When I look at the fact that in my practice, anxiety and depression has clearly tripled since I moved here to Sarasota in the last 24 years. Actually, January 1st, I celebrate 25 years being in Sarasota, and that's a reason for me to be happy. But when I get people that come in with anxiety and depression, I realize that for some people it's really bumpy. You know, 80% of those people consult some sort of a medical professional for help. And when I look at children, we're seeing depression in children. Depending on whose studies you read, 1 or 2 kids out of 10 are depressed. Boy, I can't remember hearing anything about that when I was a kid growing up. By the time that we get to 2020, and you know, that's just right around the corner, 7 years away, anxiety and depression is going to outrank accidents and violence and even AIDS as a primary cause of early death. So it's not just a matter of feeling bad. But I'm here to tell you after 30 years in practice that I got a clue that a whole lot of people are missing. And that is looking at the critically unmet nutritional needs that are contributing to anxiety and depression. You know, we really have two families of feelings. And I look to Julia Ross because Julia Ross wrote what I consider to be a really milestone book, of the book The Mood Cure, back about 10 years ago. I've taken several workshops from Julia Ross, and she helped me to understand the difference between true emotion and emotional imposters. You know, true emotions exist. There is no question that grief is real. There is no question about the fact that people that have had tragedy in their life have the true emotion of grief. I don't think there's anything more disrespectful to say to somebody that's lost a loved one than get over it. You know, it's been a year. You know, you need to pick up and move on. Because nobody can know what the process is for each individual. That's a true emotion. Fear is a true emotion. Fear helps to warn us that there's something bad that could happen. Now, granted, there are some individuals that have fear and it's unfounded, but you want to understand that fear really serves us. Anger is certainly one that serves us. You know, anger is a very healthy emotion. Resentment isn't, but anger sure is. Anger helps to defend us from abuse. You know, what makes us mad is being treated poorly. And so when I look at the way that anger has served me, I certainly can see that it's been a shield to keep me from being abused. The only thing I can't do is get rid of the abuse from people who drive 17 miles an hour down the whole length of Midnight Pass Road. Well, another of the true emotions that I certainly see in my practice is shame. And shame can happen from all sorts of things. Little and big, but what I've seen historically is shame is really a teacher. It teaches us what we need to pay attention to. So there's no denying the nature of true emotions, and there's no denying the effect that they have on the body. But what I see in my practice way too often are emotional imposters, these biochemical errors, false moods. That can happen when you've been having a good day and all of a sudden you snap. And this counterfeit mood shows up. You know, if you've lost a loved one and you're grieving, that's a true emotion. But if every time a Hallmark advertisement comes on the television, you boo-hoo, that may be false pain. I see individuals who have PMS. premenstrual syndrome. And in the 3 or 7 days prior to their monthly cycle, they have a personality shift. And some of them end up really weepy, and some of them end up really critical, and some end up with both. And what's true is this is also a false mood and motivated by hormones. So yeah, when you're feeling it, it feels real. But in fact, it's an emotional imposter. And so when I look at what I've learned over the last, well, I guess it's been about 13 or 14 years since I started working with neurotransmitters. But actually, when Prozac first came out, you know, one of the first SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, serotonin is a neurotransmitter, and serotonin is certainly related to depression. But as you've heard on No Nonsense Nutrition before, it's not just related to depression. Serotonin, it turns out, is fertilizer for little brand new baby brain cells. So we know that people that have adequate amount of serotonin have way less depression. But I was fascinated by this drug when it was first released back in the late 80s, because I knew individuals when I was still living in Colorado before I came to my senses and moved back to the west coast of Florida who didn't come out of their room. They didn't comb their hair. They didn't interact with people at all. I had a neighbor up in the mountains in Nederland, and she had been isolated for some years, an adult child of neighbors of mine. And when she went on this drug, it literally seemed like a miracle. Within 3 weeks, she was able to sit at the dinner table and eat with her mom and dad. Within a month, she was able to go out shopping for shoes for the first time in 3 years. So I really did see a shift that took place, and it made me very curious about neurotransmitters. It made me very curious because I've always believed that if you can do it with a drug, you can do it with a natural remedy. If you can do it with a drug, you can do it with a food. If you can do it with a drug, you can do it with a change in lifestyle or behavior. And so I started studying neurotransmitters back then, because I was just incredibly curious about how you could take an individual who was having such a rotten time and give them a pill every day and have them get involved with the world. But if you don't eat what you need, your normal emotions stop. And that comes after the observations of over 30 years in practice now. What are your clues? Your clues: you don't sleep well, you worry too much, you lose enthusiasm, you're always feeling overwhelmed. It's time to tune up the brain. It's time to tune up the emotional equipment in the brain, and it can be done with simple remedies, and it can be done with diet. You know, drug companies started studying neuroscience really early, back when Dr. Kenneth Bloom at the University of North Texas first found these relationships. You know, the first of the neurotransmitters that were found, endorphins, were discovered as a result of the fact that runners reported what was called the runner's high. You know, they'd be out there, you know, flapping them feet on the road, and they'd get to a place where they just couldn't go any further, and then all of a sudden they would have this burst of enthusiasm and desire to complete their run. And so they took blood samples from these people before they ran, and they took blood samples from these people after they ran, and they found out, one thing they found out was their pain threshold went up. They actually used thumb screws. I know it sounds like medieval torture, but you put your thumb in a little brace and they twist a screw down that has numbers to gauge it, and you know, at the point that you say uncle, you can't take anymore, and then you go out and run and you come back and they thumb screw the other side, and you know, you could take more pressure. So they wanted to know, what was this magical chemical that the brain was producing that was enabling people to tolerate pain? And it turned out that the brain produced an opiate. Yeah, just like opium, it produced an opiate called endorphin. And it not only made you tolerate pain better, didn't mean you didn't have pain, just meant you were able to tolerate it better. But it also created a sense of aliveness, a sense of feeling better. And so from endorphins to enkephalins, and from enkephalins to serotonin, and from serotonin just on and on. And so when I look at nutritherapy, think of that word, nutritherapy. It's nutritional therapy. Because if there are critical unmet nutritional needs in the individual, and all we're trying to do is, you know, give somebody a pharmaceutical drug to solve that problem, but those nutritional needs are unmet, ultimately that drug won't work. That's why some people go on 20 milligrams of Prozac, and 2 years later they're on 40, and a year later they're on 60, and then they come in and they're on 80, and you know what? They're still depressed. Or else they're flat. You know, we should have a range of moods. We should have highs and lows. That's a part of life. But they just become flat. No, there aren't any lows anymore, but there also aren't any highs. I don't know about you, but that isn't the kind of life I want to lead. So let's look at neurotransmitters. Let's look at the fact that every neurotransmitter, and remember, if they discovered it from the neck down, they called it a hormone. If they discovered it from the neck up, they called it a neurotransmitter. But there are neurotransmitters in your body, and there are hormones in your brain. What's the difference? Neurotransmitters work in a really short distance in the synapse between the end of one nerve and the beginning of another neuron. That little teeny tiny space. You know, you could hardly slide a piece of paper through that space. That's where neurotransmitters work. Hormones work at a distance. Your pituitary is talking to your ovaries or testes, gentlemen. Your adrenals are talking to your thyroid. I mean, there's conversation that's going on, but it's going on at a distance. Neurotransmitters, they work in a really short space. But like hormones and like enzymes, they're all proteins. And when I say protein, you might think of eggs and pork chops, but what you want to remember is that all proteins are made out of amino acids. I think of amino acids like the letters of the alphabet. We have 26 letters in our alphabet, but we can make tens of thousands of different words. We have 22 amino acids in our body, and we can make tens of thousands of different proteins. You hook the aminos together in different combinations, just like you hook letters together in different combinations to make words. And proteins are big molecules. They're at least 100 aminos in a protein. So I can remember being in Central Florida one time and having one of those great, huge, long trains go by at the crossing, 300-car long train, and it had tanker cars and flat cars and cattle cars and box cars and just cabooses and engines and all sorts of things. And I remember thinking that was a perfect metaphor for a protein. Because all these aminos are linked together, just like the couplings on those cars, and there's all sorts of different ones, 22 different ones. So this protein might have 11 of number 1 and 2 of number 2 and 8 of number 3, but the idea is they make collectively a protein. So neurotransmitters, we have to have those aminos. We have to create a well-stocked brain. It's just like your pantry. You know, I had a conversation with a client just on Saturday about what happens in my vegetable drawer. Right now, I got vegetables to beat the band. But what's true is even on the worst circumstance, I'm never out of onions, potatoes or sweet potatoes, celery, carrots, cabbage. Those half a dozen vegetables are always in my refrigerator. That's my well-stocked pantry. I can make 20 different things out of that half a dozen different vegetables. Well, you want a well-stocked brain. You want a well-stocked brain because when you've got all those aminos available, then your brain can make those proteins. But it also needs fats because the membrane of every cell is made out of fats. And when you eat funky fats, I talked to somebody again on Saturday and was eating a lot of fried food. And eat a lot of fried food, you get a lot of funky fats. You've heard me say on No Nonsense Nutrition before that even if you started out with fresh oil every day, and I guarantee you they don't, you heat that oil up to 425 degrees and leave it there for 10 hours and keep putting batch after batch after batch of food in there, you create some really gnarly compounds. And since your brain is fundamentally made out of fat, when your brain needs some fat, It grabs those gnarly fats. And those gnarly fats don't transmit messages. In order for one cell to talk to the next cell, it has to talk to it through that fat membrane. So that's the reason that the fats in nuts and seeds and avocados and fishes are so incredibly beneficial for you, because they allow that messaging system to work better. That's why we know omega-3 fatty acids, those fatty acids that come to us from salmon and tuna and herring and sardines and haddock and actually everything that comes from the sea has omega-3 fatty acids in it. That just the use of omega-3 fatty acids improves depression. Without drugs, without any other supplements, just omega-3s alone. So I get people that come into my practice on a fairly regular basis and they say, well, I inherited this. I inherited these bad moods. You know, my mother was a depressive or my father was anxious. Can you inherit mood genes? And the answer is, a little bit. There can be a predisposition that happens within a family. And when we do tests to measure the detoxification genes of the liver, these detoxification genes, remember all genes, you get one from your mama and one from your daddy. But there are a couple of really critical genes. One of the critical genes is a gene called C677, and it's a gene that has to do with how you process folic acid. We know folic acid is really critical, but some people can't convert folic acid into its active form. Folic acid actually has to become folate, and then it has to become 5-MTHF, 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate. Yeah, I know, easy for me to say. 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate. That's the active form of folic acid. Well, some people don't have the gene to make the conversion. And folic acid is critical in a whole bunch of processes. I see folic acid anemia in my practice on blood tests virtually every week. If your MCV and MCH are high on your test, MCV mean corpuscle volume, MCH mean corpuscle height. If those red blood cells are all bloated, if they have a bigger volume and a bigger height, those numbers are high, but the rest of your red blood cells are normal, well, that's folic acid anemia. You can't convert easily. It gives you higher risks of cancer, higher risks of dementia. You know, enough reason to be taking 5-MTHF as a supplement. But also, there's a gene called a COMT gene. And this gene is responsible for detoxifying a lot of the gnarlies that we have in our environment today. And people who don't have good COMT genes are individuals who have a tough time getting those toxins out, and therefore they have a higher susceptibility to some of these mood disorders. So no, you don't directly inherit it. But there could be a predisposition. We know that hormones are related. We know that lifestyle is related. But once we learn about having a well-stocked brain, we can help to lift the dark clouds or the blahs, or the stress, or the sensitivity. And let's start right away with talking about the dark clouds, because that's what I see the most often in my practice. That's a thing we call depression. You know, if your serotonin is high, you're positive and confident and flexible and easygoing. And if your serotonin is sinking, you're negative and worried and irritable and obsessive and sleepless. If that sounds familiar, then listen up. We've got this amino acid called tryptophan. And remember, amino acids have an L in front of them, L-tryptophan, just like L-lysine or L-theanine or L-tyrosine. Tryptophan as an amino acid used to be way more prevalent in our diet because we used to eat a lot of wild game. And wild game has way more tryptophan in it than grocery store meat. And why is that true? Because wild game eats what's out there in nature, and livestock generally today are corn-fed. You know, cows were never designed to eat corn. Cows were designed to eat grass. And so when you give them a corn diet, you give pigs a corn diet, you give chickens a corn diet, you end up with a low tryptophan food. You end up with low tryptophan meat. And so if you're eating grass-fed beef, you're going to get more tryptophan than you are if you're eating corn-fed beef. So tryptophan is the precursor for the neurotransmitter serotonin. Now, tryptophan doesn't just become serotonin. Tryptophan can turn into other things like niacin. But fundamentally, tryptophan turns into serotonin. And when I look at individuals, especially vegans and vegetarians, there's no question about the fact that they are at greater risk. They are at greater risk of depression because they eat a low tryptophan diet. Now, if you happen to be one of the very creative vegetarians who's really, you know, especially if you're a lacto-ovo vegetarian, you're getting eggs and you're getting dairy, or even if you're just an ovo vegetarian and you're just getting eggs in, your risk reduces. But unless you're eating the high tryptophan foods like pumpkin and nuts and seeds, well, your risk is higher. It's higher for people who skip meals. You know, the body needs the supply of tryptophan all day long. And so when I look at you mamas that are listening to me out there, and you mamas that are doing such a good job with keeping your babies on the breast, you're giving your kid an advantage because there's more tryptophan in the breast milk than there is in formula or cow's milk or soy milk. You know, when you read the book, The Crazy Makers was really a milestone book for me. How the food industry is destroying our brains and harming our children. It helps us to understand that when we feed children a formula that is low in tryptophan, we end up with a grumpy two-year-old. And two-year-olds are grumpy at best. I see tryptophan deficiencies showing up in people that are on low-fat diets. There's a lot of people out there that still think fat is a four-letter word. And yet, we clearly see that when people were given a diet that had 40% fat in it, that their depression was relieved over and above the individuals who were given a 20% fat diet. There are enemies to serotonin. And one of the big enemies to serotonin is caffeine. You know, I'm happy to say that the intern that I had in my practice last year, Mariah, is going to be coming back over the Christmas holidays from Florida State. And she's going to be helping me load a lot of these shows onto the podcast, you know, Eve Plew's podcasts. And the show that I did 2 weeks ago on caffeine and what caffeine does to you, we'll get it loaded. But caffeine is an enemy for depression. And it seems counterintuitive. It seems like, oh, that would be a boost. It's only a boost if you have that single cup first thing in the morning. After that, you start getting bad news. But the worst of the bad news, the worst of the enemies, as far as I'm concerned, for depression, is aspartame. It's that little packet of artificial sweetener that you put in your coffee. It's that diet drink. Aspartame is in over 4,000 products now. You find it in the yogurt. You find it in the cookies. You find it in the cereal. Aspartame has two real important aminos in it, phenylalanine. And phenylalanine is competitive. Phenylalanine migrates to another set of aminos, tyrosine, and tyrosine turns around and supports norepinephrine and epinephrine. So it's the agitating side, the anxiety side for some individuals. But more than that, it's the aspartic acid. The aspartic acid that is in aspartame, hence the name aspartame, aspartic acid, is very competitive to tryptophan. So if you're putting artificial sweeteners and things and drinking diet whatever, and it doesn't matter whether it's diet tea or diet soda or diet yogurt, you're contributing to the depression. You know, women produce about a third less serotonin than men do across the board. I am not sure why Mother Nature set us up that way, but that's the reason that we see women that have more tendencies toward depression. And that's one of the reasons the B vitamins are so critical. You know, in a high-quality multivitamin, multimineral, you should have enough Bs in there for adequacy. And again, the Bs have to be activated Bs, just like we talked about activated folic acid. So B vitamins are critical when it comes to treating depression. Even light is critical. You've heard about SAD, seasonal affective disorder, the depression that occurs for people who live in Anchorage and live in northern Minnesota and, you know, live in Cincinnati where it's gray for 3 weeks at a time. You know, you get a cloudy winter a day. They measure light by something called lux, L-U-X, and these are the light units that are measured. And on a cloudy wintry day, you might get 2,000 lux if you go outside. But if you go out in the bright sky, the gorgeous, bright, sunshiny day we had yesterday, even in the wintertime, you'll have 100,000 lux. So getting people in front of bright lights, I mean, even a 200-watt bulb that they sit in front of for 30 minutes a day can lift depression. You know, exercise is one of the things that lifts depression, and exercise lifts depression simply because when you exercise, you break down muscle fibers. And when you break down muscle fibers, all the rest of the amino acids run in there in order to support and strengthen the muscle. Well, tryptophan is kind of an unusual amino because it's sort of the run of the litter. It has a hard time getting across the blood-brain barrier. But if you get the body busy, if you will, rebuilding muscle, like what happens when you exercise, it lets the tryptophan get to the brain. So you get a little bump of feeling better when you exercise. And you do that both from the exercise and you do it from getting more oxygen into the body. And if you double the value by exercising outside, you get the benefit of the light as well as the exercise. This is especially true for those of you that have afternoon and evening cravings. If you're one of those people that the second you walk in the door after work, you just have an eat-a-thon until you go to bed at night, you know, going from one snacky to another. If you exercise at the end of the day, after work, instead of in the beginning of the morning, you'll actually reduce your afternoon and evening cravings. You know, individuals that have depression. It was interesting to me when I was living in northern Arizona and I was spending more time up on the reservations, especially the Hopi and the Navajo reservation, and I found out that they didn't have a word for depression in their First Nation language. I was surprised because depression really means different things to different people. You know, there are individuals that depression is real. Actually, nothing but anger. And there are individuals that depression is low self-esteem. There are individuals in depression is the fact that they're perfectionists and they can't ever seem to do it good enough. They can't do it in such a way that they feel like they've achieved. So there really are different kinds of depression. But all of them can be improved when we improve the well-stocked brain with serotonin. You know, people who have a lot of pain from TMJ and pain from migraines and pain from fibromyalgia, these are almost always people that are very low in serotonin. The other thing that Dr. Harvey and I discussed, and Dr. Harvey will be on next Monday as usual, the third Monday of the month, is I did a neurotransmitter test. And by the way, these neurotransmitter tests are urine collections, and we're not actually measuring the neurotransmitter directly because in order to do that, you'd have to do a brain biopsy, and that's a little messy for my clinic. But when we measure these downstream metabolites of these neurotransmitters, we can extrapolate from that information the relationship to the neurotransmitters in the brain. And consistently, when I've done these tests, I've compared notes with other clinicians that do these tests. And now that I've done over 2,200 of these neurotransmitter tests over the last dozen years, it's really, you know, given me quite a handle on it. And one day I got a test back and had the lowest serotonin number I'd ever seen. And I called Dr. Harvey up and I said, have you ever seen a number this low? And he said, yeah, as a matter of fact, I just had somebody in my office last week, a teenage boy, and he was a gamer. He was coming home from school, and he was doing video games, and they had to literally pry him away from the video console in order to eat dinner with the family. And, you know, it was just, you know, hair pulling in order to get the kid to do his homework and his chores and such, because he just wanted to be on that computer. And as he was telling me that story, the light bulb went on, and the test that I had in front of me was from a kid who was a gamer. And so I don't know what that mechanism of action is. I don't know why sitting in front of a video console all day long made the serotonin go low. I don't know if it was because all the gaming is acts of violence, or it was just the video games themselves, or sitting in front of the computer itself. But Dr. Harvey and I have certainly seen that commonality, especially with youth, where they've been gaming for a long time during the day, driving their serotonin down. You know, serotonin's not just produced in the brain, it's also produced in the gut. About 90% of the serotonin that's in your body is produced in your gut. You know, if you're an individual who's chronically constipated and you've eaten all the fiber you're going to eat and taken probiotics and, you know, had prunes and figs when you got up in the morning and have done everything to get the plumbing working, well, you might be able to get the plumbing working by supporting that pathway of tryptophan and then 5-HTP. 5-HTP, 5-hydroxytryptophan. It's one step closer to serotonin. So it goes like this. You eat the protein has tryptophan in it, the tryptophan turns into 5-HTP, and the 5-HTP turns into serotonin. When you have depression, you must, if you want to feel better, eat a protein breakfast. If you get up and have a bagel, if you have a piece of toast with jelly, if you eat a bowl of Sugar Bomb cereals, or you don't have anything for breakfast, you're just wanting the depression to go on. You know, I'm over this nonsense where people say, well, I just don't feel like eating breakfast. Well, I don't care whether you feel like it or not. Your body requires this. And when you wait 2 hours after you get out of the bed in order to put something in your body, you have already cascaded all the stress hormones because you were in the bed for 8 hours, you haven't had any food for 10 or 12 hours, and your body is scavenging for amino acids at that point because you have no ability to store protein in your body. You sure as heck can store fat. We got no doubt about that. You can store carbohydrates, but you can't store protein. So 5-HTP is your, well, in this particular instance, it could be your savior. 5-HTP works for about 85% of the people that I give it to. And you know, in the studies, 5-HTP outperforms SSRIs, the antidepressant drugs, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. You know, when Prozac was given, it increased serotonin by 150%. But when Prozac was given with 5-HTP, it increased serotonin 615%. And the other thing is there's no sexual dysfunction. A lot of people complain that these antidepressants, and it doesn't matter what their name is. I'm not picking on Prozac. I mean, it can happen with Lexapro and Celexa, and, you know, I could read the whole list to you. But very many individuals have sexual dysfunction, especially the males. But about 15% of people are not really very responsive to 5-HTP, or 5-HTP has a counter effect and it makes them edgy. Those people just need straight tryptophan. And, you know, some people got scared of tryptophan because there was a bad batch that came out of Japan back in 1989. It was a horrible thing. And the laboratory in Japan that shipped it to the United States knew it was a bad batch when they shipped it, killed 40 people. And so everybody got spooky about tryptophan, and tryptophan was off the market for 6 years. But since 1995, tryptophan has been available on the market, and it never came off the market in Europe. In fact, during that period from 89 to 95, I was actually buying it when I was in England and bringing it back with me. So we've never had another bad batch. This particular Japanese lab used genetically engineered bacteria to grow the tryptophan. That's a whole story in and of itself, but suffice it to say, anybody going, oh, you got to be careful of that tryptophan, is really dealing with 17-year-old news. The two other things that I've seen that have really made a difference in terms of depression are St. John's wort and CME. St. John's wort as an herb. There's 16 different species of Hypericum, or St. John's wort, that grow in the state of Florida, but none of them happen to be the medicinal variety. This pretty little yellow flower just looks so innocuous, kind of a little weed. But there's a specific species of Hypericum, or St. John's wort, called Hypericum perfoliatum. And that is the medicinal constituent. And you know, when they laid St. John's wort directly next to an antidepressant, St. John's wort outperformed it. But here's what the pharmaceutical company did, and it shows you what shysters they are. Everybody who's a competent herbalist knows that St. John's wort is to be used for mild to moderate depression. Not severe depression. Not intractable depression. Not what's known as reflective depression. But they specifically took people who were severely depressed and they gave them St. John's wort, and then they came back and they said it didn't work. Well, you know, I finally got the study and I read the whole study, and it turned out that St. John's wort worked equally well to their drug, but it still did not relieve this kind of intractable depression. But for mild to moderate depression, St. John's wort works great. And so does Sammy. When we look at the nature of SAMe, you know, it really is a very, very special molecule. And this special molecule of S-adenosyl-L-methionine, and again, you hear L-methionine, you know that that's an amino acid, and this is a particular form. It's a chemical found naturally in every cell of our body, and it's critical to many cellular functions, including the production of serotonin and other mood-regulating neurotransmitters. We all have some SAMe, but SAMe in depressed people is very low, and it gets depleted by a poor diet, especially if B12 and folic acid, which are needed for its production, are not in the diet, or they're lost because people are just drinking too much, or they're using stimulants, or they're just aging. So SAMe works well. But if you have enough aminos and you combine them with the B vitamins, you may not need to add anything else. I use SAMe if the aminos don't work, and I use St. John's wort if it doesn't completely relieve the depressive symptoms, specifically in people over 40 years old, and specifically where stimulants, alcohol, etc. are a piece of the problem, or if somebody has arthritis. SAMe is something else that we can use for arthritis. SAMe is a very, very delicate molecule. You have to make sure that if you're taking SAMe, that you're taking it in little pillow packs where it's sealed, because SAMe is very humidity sensitive. And if you just have a bottle of pills and it's exposed to the humidity, then it's going to lose its potency really quick. It's a very delicate molecule. So are you one of the people that gets the holiday blahs instead of the blues? Are you one of the people that has to have stimulants? And rather than going down the Prozac antidepressant road, you're looking for Adderall and Ritalin and Wellbutrin and all the stimulant side of the treatment. Well, then you may be an individual that needs L-tyrosine. L-tyrosine is really the energizer. I did a show just about a month ago on the adrenal glands and all of the things that the adrenal glands need. And tyrosine is one of the critical amino acids for the adrenal glands. Once again, we will see that with this particular population, we will see depression as well, but we'll see apathy. I don't care. I don't care. Doesn't matter. I don't care. That kind of apathy always tells me that tyrosine is needed. I see it with attention deficits as well. Tyrosine is one of the things that I use to treat children that have attention problems, and adults, not just kids. Well, there's plenty of tyrosine in eggs and chicken breast. There's about 100 milligrams in every ounce of four-legged animal, like beef. You get 400 milligrams if you eat a four-ounce burger. But you get 900 milligrams in a chicken breast. And you get almost 300 milligrams in every egg that you eat. But if you're a vegetarian and you just take a handful of almonds, all you're going to get is about 150 milligrams. So once again, it's hard to get enough of these amino in on a vegetarian and a vegan diet. And that's especially true because soy inhibits the conversion of tyrosine into your thyroid hormones. You know, when I find low-calorie dieters or people that are vegans and vegetarians that are using a lot of soy, I will often see the blahs. I will often see the individual that needs stimulants. I had a vegan in my practice here a couple of weeks ago who was drinking 48 ounces of coffee a day because without that coffee, she felt like she couldn't get up and go. And I quote my daddy, her get up and go got up and went. Now, if you overdo tyrosine, you'll get jittery. 500 milligrams taken first thing in the morning as soon as your feet hit the floor helps virtually everybody. And if you don't get a bump from that, 15 minutes later, you can try another 500 milligram. Well, you may be one of those people that two 500s is too much and you need 750. You're going to have to kind of diddle around with that. You know, there's a difference between the craft and the art of treatment. But what happens with tyrosine? Tyrosine really does a stellar job in terms of increasing alertness. It increases what are known as the catecholamines. You know, Julia Ross, in this book that I'm quoting often today of The Mood Cure, speaks about the CATs for a shortening for catecholamines. And catecholamines are epinephrine, which you also know as adrenaline, and norepinephrine and dopamine. And these catecholamines all require tyrosine in order for your body to make them. And so Julia Ross refers to catecholamines as the angry cats or the sleeping cats. And it's a cute way for us to identify with the fact that, you know, within us we have these nuances of mood. And so if we want to wake up those sleeping cats, tyrosine is one of the ways to do it. And for some of my clients, they need a capsule of tyrosine as soon as their feet hit the floor. And they need another capsule of tyrosine about 30 minutes or so before lunch. Again, the reason that we put these aminos in all by themselves 30 minutes before a meal is because we want the brain to uptake them without competing with those eggs you're going to have for breakfast. So, yeah, it's true. I could end up getting 500 plus milligrams of tyrosine in my couple of eggs for breakfast, but I'd still recommend that you took 500 milligrams all by itself because then it's not competing with the other aminos that are in the eggs to get into your brain. Tyrosine is not a good idea for you to take it after 3 o'clock in the afternoon because of the very thing that we're using it for, to create alertness and stimulation. You know, anytime I have somebody and they're ready to quit smoking, and we're at that time of the year where a whole lot of people are very successful at quitting smoking on New Year's, and they go on Zyban, which is just another name for Wellbutrin, and they do so because nicotine is speed. You know, nicotine only takes 7 seconds to cross the blood-brain barrier. It's actually faster than cocaine. So people that get up and say, oh, the best cigarette of the day is the first cigarette of the day. That's because all those nicotine receptors have been offloaded during your sleep, and so you get a buzz from that first cigarette. Those are people that for sure need tyrosine. I mean, I've seen people double their success rate of stopping smoking as a result of using tyrosine first thing in the morning as soon as they get up when they start the elimination of cigarettes. Once again, we can have an individual who doesn't have enough tyrosine get even worse from eating soy foods, from eating millet, from eating even wheat, rye, and barley, not because of celiac disease or even because of a sensitivity, but because it can interfere with the manufacturing of these thyroid hormones, T4 and T3. Just like water, you've heard me say before that the chlorine in water, the bromine that's in wheat, these things can interfere with the ability to make thyroid hormones. What's the first clue? You contribute to the blahs, and you get cold hands and feet easily. You're one of those people that when you sit down to watch TV for an hour, you end up with chilly toes or you're wearing socks to bed. So if melancholy is a part of the holiday season for you, then maybe you want to look at the nature of anxiety and depression. Maybe you want to look at these critically unmet nutritional needs and realize it may not be your hardwiring. It may not be because your mama was a grump and your daddy was lazy. It may not have anything to do with your genetic history. It may not even have anything to do with your aging parent or your lousy teenager or your tough situation in life. It may just have to do with the fact that you don't have your brain supplied with what it needs. So, a well-stocked brain, I can't think of anything better for the holiday season. And what does that say? It says you got to eat a protein breakfast. You got to eat a protein breakfast. You got to eat a protein breakfast. But you knew that. You've heard it from me before on No-Nonsense Nutrition. And when you go up on eveplews.com and you read some of my old columns, or you go on eveplews/podcast and you find some of the shows that I've done before, you're going to hear it over and over again. We got to get protein first thing in the morning. We evolved to do that. We evolved to get out of the cave when the sun came up and go hunting right away and grab that egg out of the bird's nest and grab the bird and get that protein into us right away because your brain needs it. So if you want to feel good during the holiday season, consider that you may not have a character flaw. You may just have a critically unmet nutritional need.